Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
What the Trump administration has done, cum grosso, is to turn the United States Navy into a death squad.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, Bulwark contributor, and I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, how was your Thanksgiving?
It was great. There were 16 of us, I think.
Wow.
Seven of them, 14 or under, so it was lively. There was a very, very large turkey, which my wife cooked beautifully, and I kind of massacred with a knife and a fork, but everybody got fed, and so it was all good. What about yours?
Ours was great. We didn't have quite as many folks. Well, I guess we had almost that number at our dinner, which my sister-in-law hosted down on the Eastern Shore where we were staying. No one is foolish enough to let me get anywhere near a turkey with a carving instrument, because the results would be really ugly. Let's turn to, it's been a very busy period, even though there was a holiday in there, lots of jackassery to choose from, but I've got like a personal stake in my nominee for Jackassery of the Week. For 11 years, I was privileged to sit on the board of the United States Institute of Peace, a small institution in Washington created by the Congress back in the 1980s, and with the mission of promoting peace. Interestingly, some of its biggest supporters are actually members of the uniformed military who've seen a lot of the work that institute did on a shoestring, really. It had about a budget of kind of mid $30 million a year as a line item. Sometimes it got kicked up to 50, 55 million a year with interagency transfers, because the Department of Defense and some other agencies transferred money to USIP to run programs, because it could run them as a non-governmental institution without the, being tied to, Uncle Sam and the government, and did a lot of good work in Iraq, a lot of good work in Afghanistan after the Arab Spring, a lot of good work in places like Libya, Tunisia, a lot of good work in stabilization in Colombia, rule of law programs, etc. And yesterday, the Secretary of State tweeted out that in honor of all of his achievements in bringing peace, the U.S. Institute of Peace, which at his direction DOGE tried to destroy and which is now in litigation, would be renamed the Donald J. Trump Institute of Peace.
Well, they haven't yet tried to rename Voice of America Voice of Trump, but they could try something like that. I saw that, and my first thought was, it's going to be really annoying for the next administration, because if they're sensible, what they're going to begin doing is just having a whole bunch of guys with hammer and chisels taking out those names, trying to melt down all the guilt that's been spilled all over the place. There's now this kind of ludicrous sort of gilt lettering outside the Oval Office that says the Oval Office.
I think that's in case Trump forgets where he's supposed to go in the morning when he comes down from the residence.
I mean, it really is striking. I think the final word on the decor of the Trump administration was said by George Will, who in his 80s is still very much on a roll. He says the basic aesthetic is that of a Gilded Age bordello.
Yeah.
I think that's about right. But no, this is it. I guess the thing that really strikes me is there's now just a routine level of sycophancy, which they all take for granted. I mean, the rest of us can roll our eyes and be disgusted. But I think it's also part of a larger phenomenon. There was a very good piece in The Atlantic by Jonathan Lemire called The Bubble Wrap Presidency. I don't know if you saw that.
I did.
In which he talked about the way in which every president operates in a bubble. But Trump, more than most, and more than he did in his first term. And one of his points was, not only does he not have people of independent stature around him as sort of Jim Mattis or John Bolton or something like that, and he doesn't. I mean, all he has is sycophants around him. He doesn't get out much. I mean, if he travels, he's traveling overseas, where he's, of course, treated like a monarch. When he's in the States, he goes to Mar-a-Lago, Bedminster, or the White House. And so the result is that these guys are even more and more insulated from reality. They live in a world where this sort of stuff is perfectly okay instead of being sick-making. And I think it is getting them in trouble. The thing which doesn't quite count as jackassery, but I think is sort of an interesting little event, really two women, Marjorie Taylor Greene, kind of sticking it to Trump, but also Elise Stefanik sticking it to Mike Johnson, who has been, as Speaker of the House, has really been dutiful in doing whatever, absolutely whatever, Trump told him to do. In both cases, I think these are, I think Stefanik is a lot smarter than Greene, but I think they are both politically cunning. And I think in both cases, they've calculated that some kind of break with Trump is not necessarily the worst thing in the world for their futures. I mean, I'm thinking Stefanik is running for governor of New York. And I just suspect you're going to have more and more of that kind of thing, where people outside that bubble of sycophancy and truckling are going to say, we're going to have to make our own future here. And it may not be a bad thing for us to have some distance from the president. That may be wishful thinking on my part. I don't know.
Well, on Elise, I would note that with the exception of one poll that was done by the Manhattan Institute, the institutional home of Christopher Rufo, the other polls, all which showed her ahead by 1 point of Kathy Hochul for governor of New York, all the other polling shows her running 20 to 25 points behind. And I think the odds of her winning are slim under any set of circumstances. However, some break, with Trump might actually, help her a bit. I probably should point out that, the timing of the renaming of the Institute of Peace was driven, I think, by the fact that they held an event there today where the president was able to get the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda, who have been embroiled in a very nasty, war that has not gotten nearly enough attention given the number of people who are being killed in it. This war has gone on for years, but he's gotten them to agree essentially to negotiate. Now, there's still fighting going on. The M23 militia that Rwanda has supported on Congo's eastern border is still shooting and killing Congolese soldiers, I'm sure, as we speak. But this is one of the eight wars he stopped, in his quest for the Nobel Peace Prize. And, it's, of a piece with everything Trump, right? It's a vast oversell of what it is. And that's what seems to have driven the timing. It's not just the U.S. Institute of Peace. He wants to have the Kennedy Center renamed for him. He wants the new, hopefully domed stadium that the owners of the Washington Commanders are building with the help of the city of Washington, D.C., the municipal government, and the feds. He wants that named after him. You know, it just never ends with his, you know, his gnawing insecurity just requires this kind of constant ego gratification. The Jonathan Lemire article that you talked about in The Atlantic, very, very telling, I think. There's another one in today in Politico magazine by Jonathan Martin that is also very good, which is about Trump living his best life. I mean, it's basically Trump's idea in the second term is to barely actually function as president. It's to hold these three-hour cabinet meetings where people slather him with, you know, praise with a very thick trowel, even as he is dozing off in the midst of it, by the way. To go to the halftime of the Commanders football game and then appear in the broadcast booth so he can kibitz about the game. It's to build a giant ballroom next to the White House. It's to have swanky Gatsby themed parties at Mar-a-Lago, to go golfing, with Bryson DeChambeau. I mean, it's just none of it is about being president of the United States and actually doing the job.
Well, in the interest of fairness, before we move on to substance, I want to say that if he replaces the people movers at Dulles Airport, I will be all in favor of there being a Donald Trump walkway, you know, that goes from the main terminal out to the satellites. And if they want to cover it with gold, that's fine with me. I'm sure he can shake down plenty of businesses that will do that. And if they want to have, like, they want his name and flashing gold neon lights, I'll be happy because I hate those things.
I do too, but I hope that he doesn't, you know, disfigure the Aero Saarinen architecture.
He actually likes it, apparently. But
yeah, well, we'll see. He said he wasn't going to touch the East Wing either. So
yeah, well, there's that. All right, there's really kind of darkly important stuff. Should we start with Venezuela and then?
Yes, I think we should start with Venezuela because today was, you know, at least one of Pete Hegseth's, you know, worst days in office, I'm sure. A lot of different things today that Secretary Hegseth's in the middle of. First of all, there's the testimony in closed session with the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees of Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley, who gave the order for the so-called double tap killing on early September, off the coast of Venezuela. Allegedly, Bradley said there was no kill them all order. There was no quarter order. That's according to Tom Cotton, who came out of the briefings and said that. But on the other hand, Congressman Jim Himes, who's been a guest on Shield of the Republic and who we hope to have back in the new year, came out saying this was one of the most disturbing briefings he's ever had as a member. And he saw the video. They did show them the video of apparently more than two strikes on this vessel. We can talk about the legality of all this, which I think we should. All in all, I can't imagine this was a good day for Hegseth, who, I didn't know this was a verb or it can be a verbal noun, but Hegseth, you know, the other day at the cabinet meeting underbust, Admiral Bradley by basically having said earlier he was responsible for the orders, saying, no, I didn't see the second strike. I don't know anything about it, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, well, I think in that regard, Hegseth, whose reputation, frankly, with the general and flag officer corps is in the mud anyway, he has walked away from any kind of accountability, and that stuff rankles with the military. And it will affect what sort of advice they give and what they are willing to do. You know, I will defer to the lawyers about whether this is technically a war crime, but it feels like a war crime to me. I do think they're legit. Apparently the defense of this is that these sailors were trying to recover some of the bales of narcotics that were floating around in the water after their boat got hit. Now, you'd have to see the video to say, you know, maybe are they trying to grab something that floats so that they can avoid drowning? That would be entirely possible. But in any case, the only rationale for doing it would be if they are still combatants. Now, they weren't combatants to begin with. They may well be criminals. But what the Trump administration has done, cum grosso, is to turn the United States Navy into a death squad.
Right.
That's really what we're doing. We're taking people who are not, let's face it, these people are not terrorists who are running into the United States to plant bombs or something like that. They're trying to ship cocaine, actually, probably not to the United States, to Europe.
Correct.
They are criminals. They're unquestionably criminals. That I don't doubt. And what you're supposed to do is arrest them. And that's why you have
code. We don't summarily execute criminals in the United States. Exactly.
And it's why naval vessels often have Coast Guard officers on them, so that who are law enforcement officers who have the authority to arrest people and so forth. So there is a profound problem with this. That's point one. Point two, even if Hegseth did not give an order, no quarter order, the tone, any leader sets a tone in the whole organization. And there's a command climate. There's, you know what the boss wants. And unquestionably, he has set that kind of tone. And then I even if that is true, there's a third point, which is, it seems to me Admiral Mitchell does have some questions he needs to answer, because at the end of the day, he is the guy who gives the order. And I will tell you, and at the risk of seriously annoying some people who are potentially very lethal, I have always had a lot of concerns about SEAL Team 6. So for the technical background for some of our listeners, the Army has Delta Force. It's a very, very elite special operations force for originally, all these things were basically hostage rescue organizations, but they're basically for very, very exquisite, dangerous special operations. And the Navy created the same thing, SEAL Team 6. From the very beginning, SEAL Team 6 really pushed the boundaries. Its first commander, Richard Marcinko, actually ended up in jail. They have had many more members who've gone around publishing memoirs, by and large, which is not a good thing. Delta has not had that so much. And I have always, well, I have the highest regard for many of these people, and they've done heroic things and been exposed to terrible dangers. And many of them are highly principled military people. I think it's always important to be very, very careful about special operators, because they do, precisely because they do so many extraordinary things, and all of which involve really pushing the edge of anything. Giving them discretionary authority to go around killing people is very serious business. And I wouldn't be surprised if one of the reasons why Admiral Halsey, the Southcom commander, quit was because the task was being given to the Joint Special Operations Command, which was not responding to him. In other words, he should have been the guy making the call, and it sounds like he was completely out of the picture.
I should, Elliot, for the audience, I should point out that in the dim, dark past, at the beginning of your academic career, your first published work was on special operations forces. As I recall, one of the points you make is there are very, very small number of people who can actually kind of do this kind of stuff, because it does require a certain kind of psychological balance, and they do a lot of psychological testing and evaluation for folks in these highly specialized units. But I think it's fair to say that one of the downsides of the war on terror was we dramatically increased the size of our special forces. And I think we may have, you know, inadvertently, because we did it, you know, taken in a number of people who maybe weren't, you know, really quite capable of doing all that. I mean, that's a little bit of a digression from the main point here, but I mean, I quite agree with you that this is something that has to be watched very carefully. you know, Admiral Bradley could, you know, apparently made the argument that they were trying to call for help, and that it continued to, you know, do their drug mission. Well, I don't know how he can know that. I mean, perhaps, you know, they intercepted the call from, you know, from one of the survivors. Why wouldn't you wait for the vessel to arrive, you know, and then hit that as another target if that were the case? I mean, the Department of Defense, you know, law of war manual has very specific language about striking, you know, victims of shipwreck caused by war. And Jack Goldsmith, who's a former general counsel, had a terrific Substack post on this whole subject, which, I mean, his conclusion is clear there's a war crime and maybe murder.
Well, look, do I really think that in real time they would have intercepted the call, translated it? Because I doubt it. I mean, maybe Admiral Bradley's fluent in Spanish or whatever language they were speaking. And figured all that out and then ordered the double tap. I tend to doubt that. And they're not combatants in the sense that, you know, they're blazing away, as far as we know, maybe they were, but I kind of doubt it, that they were blazing away with missiles and so forth. I just want to get back to one other thing about special operations forces, or actually several other things. One, American special operations forces increasingly are like a branch of the armed services. In other words, they may, you know, you may in theory be part of the Navy, but you're really off either in JSOC or the Special Operations Command, which is sort of an umbrella organization. And they are rather distant quite frequently from the services. And whereas the services have civilian secretaries and some sort of civilian oversight, Special Operations Forces, they're under an Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations, low intensity conflict, reported to you when you were undersecretary. They're not there really to exercise real civilian oversight of the kind that a service secretary does. So that's one thing. Second thing is politicians love these guys. First, because it's, you know, derring do and macho and things of that kind, but because they seem like a very reliable kind of instrument. So look, I'm sure Admiral Bradley is a sterling figure. Fine. But this really sounds deeply, deeply problematic. And, you know, the fact also that the administration has just sort of been dismissive about it, particularly Hegseth, this whole thing is a terrible mess. I hope the video is released. It was interesting. Senator Wicker, the Senate Armed Services Committee chairman, did not say anything after the hearing. There was, I think, in the House, somebody, one of the Republicans did. And even what Cotton said was sort of a statement of fact. It wasn't his conclusive judgment. And, you know, I don't know where he stands on all that. The broader context here, though, is, which we also have to talk about, is what could be launching a war against Venezuela.
Yeah. I mean, before we leave the double tap strike and go to the broader question of Venezuela, you know, you raised with me this morning, you texted me the Mark Thiessen article in the Washington Post. Oh, yes,
you should speak to that.
And in this, Mark, who, you know, we should stipulate, was our former colleague in the Bush 43 administration.
But that won't protect him.
And it won't protect him. It makes the argument that, you know, President Obama really laid the predicate for all this because of all the droning that he did. I mean, and there were a lot of drone strikes during the Obama administration. These were so-called signature or pattern of life strikes, which involved, you know, hitting suspected terrorists, mostly in remote parts of Pakistan or Afghanistan, where we had trouble actually reaching physically because the terrain was, you know, difficult, or because they were being protected politically by local authorities or what have you. And I, you know, I would, you know, say a couple of things about that. He's saying this is the same thing, you know, and therefore everyone, before they start screaming war crime, should, you know, take a breath and whatnot. So what to make of that argument? I think it's a potentially fair criticism of the Obama administration that they over relied on these kinds of strikes, which, you know, full disclosure, began when you and I were in office. And we began them because it was, we thought, an important part of trying to prevent attacks on the homeland, because plotting was going on. We knew that, and we couldn't get to these people pretty much any other way. I think it's fair to say that Obama over-relied on this. And one of the reasons the Obama administration over-relied on these things was that they preferred not to interrogate people. In the wake of all the, you know, brouhaha over quote torture, unquote, the enhanced interrogation techniques, waterboarding, etc. Now, I think it's important for people to understand that on 9/11, after the attacks, how little we knew about Al-Qaeda. I mean, we did not know very much. And there was a period in the, you know, middle of the, you know, global war on terror, I would say in the period from 2001 to maybe 2005-06, where almost everything we knew about plans, plots, what they were doing was coming from interrogation of Al-Qaeda people. If you were not going to rely on, you know, physical interrogation, then it, you know, you had to rely on drones. But it also, though, I think saying we don't want to rely on interrogation also sent an unintended message to folks in the field, particularly special forces guys in the field, who were involved in a lot of, as you and I know from our travels to Afghanistan together and separately, were involved in a lot of so-called hunter-killer operations going after terrorists, which is to say, if we can't interrogate them, you know, and can't use them to generate more intelligence to go after other, you know, other targets, then maybe we don't want to be taking prisoners. That's not a no quarter order, but it's an unintended consequence of saying we're not going to rely on interrogation, and or we want to discourage reliance on, you know, interrogation. But with all that said, to compare these strikes against people who had sworn bayat, allegiance, that is, to a leader who had declared a jihad on the United States, inflicted more deaths on our soil than any adversary since the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, and cost $2 trillion of damage to the United States economy. To compare that to a bunch of fishermen being recruited to, you know, for $500 to run drugs to Trinidad to go to Europe, as you said, it's obscene to make the comparison. No. There is no comparison.
Well, particularly when you also pointed out that going into the hinterlands of Yemen is one thing. The United States Navy has total dominance over the Caribbean, so it's not as though, you know, these people are unreachable.
And the Coast Guard was intercepting these ships all the time.
Yeah. Now, the one thing that I think is striking about this, and it's something that needs to be thought about for the future, really two questions. One which we sort of dodged, I think, during the long war, the war on terror, is what is crime and what is war? And I think it is very important to think about that. And in the distinction I would draw is crime is something that is done for personal gain or out of sadism, you know, where you just want to see people suffer, or you want to make money in some way or gain some other asset. War is, in one sense or another, using violence for some larger political or religious motive. And there, that is a big distinction. And I do think that what we're seeing here is criminal activity. The other thing is not criminal activity. It is definable as war. So that's one issue. The other issue, though, that is very important is this technology actually began evolving, I think, in fact, under the Clinton administration. But now technology makes possible a very systematic use of assassination or targeted killing. Now, there are precedents. The British officers thought it was very unfair when Virginia riflemen were picking off officers in the wilderness of upstate New York during the American Revolution. But now you really can go after individuals all over the place in very, very targeted ways. And it's something routine. And I think we're going to be, we haven't really fully taken on board what the consequences of this are, because on the whole, we and the Israelis have been the ones who've been doing this most, but lots of other people can do it too. And that's an issue. But that said, we do need to talk about the broader issue, which is Venezuela. And now let me give you my take, and I'd be curious to hear your reaction. I think of my guess is Secretary Rubio would very much like to see the overthrow of the Venezuelan regime, as would I. I mean, I would like to see it be replaced by a democracy. That's there were elections. There was a democratic winner. That's all to the good. That said, it seems to me that what I believe Trump believes, and possibly Rubio, is that you can assemble so much military muscle. You can do so many threatening things, like saying, we don't think anybody should be flying into Venezuela, that you'll get Maduro to fold. And maybe you will. And maybe be replaced by a decent government. But there are two problems with that. One is, what happens if he doesn't fold? In which case, you either have the choice of backing down yourself, because you're not going to keep the aircraft carrier there forever, or you're going to begin a series of strikes, which is actually a war against a sovereign state, which they will probably try to do without an authorization for the use of military force from Congress. Now, they're actually, the Thiessen argument, I think, does hold up, because that's exactly what Obama did in Libya. And that was wrong then, and it would be, by the way, unlike George W. Bush, who did get authorizations for the use of military force from Congress. So I think once you begin military operations, okay, suppose if you do nail Maduro, that's one outcome, but suppose you don't get him, how many strikes? Do you think you can do this completely by air? Do you end up having to do something on the ground? I mean, it then becomes a war. It's a lopsided war, but a war is nonetheless a war. The second big question is, what sort of democratic transition do we really think is going to be possible? It's a consummation devoutly to be wished. But surely if there's one thing that we should have learned, that I feel I've learned, is regimes like the Venezuelan one, as corrupt and incompetent as they are, have, thanks to the internationalization of repressive technique and technology, really gotten pretty good at suppressing populations. And it's a combination of militias and Cuban secret police and Chinese facial recognition technology and Russian advisors of, you know, of different kinds. So, you know, what sort of transition? Very last thing I'll say is on that one, and this actually ties into the Trump slapping his name on the Institute of Peace. If Maduro simply goes down, let's say we drop a bomb on him and kill him, Trump will say, okay, that's a success. Venezuelan policy is all over. Even though, of course, from the point of view of Venezuela, that's just the beginning of the story. So those are my initial thoughts on it.
I don't disagree. Couple of additional things I might add to what you've said. One is it's still not clear what the motive is, and it's not clear what the objective is. I mean, Trump had a phone call with Maduro where he tried to get Maduro to leave. And apparently Maduro was not totally opposed to the idea. I mean, he was open to it, apparently. But it foundered, according to the press reports, on the issue of whether he would be given a full and complete legal amnesty for any crimes he may have committed. I mean, he's under indictment in the United States for narcotics trafficking, and he is aware of what happened to Manuel Noriega, who, you know, was taken out of Panama and was remanded to the United States, where he sits in, you know, in a maximum security prison now in the United States. He apparently couldn't get that out of Trump. And so, you know, he said, no dice, no deal. He's obviously concerned about his security. He's brought in a lot of additional Cuban security, by all accounts, to, you know, make sure he's not droned or, you know, spirited off by, by SEAL Team 6 or Delta Force. The president, as you say, has no interest in a kind of democratic regime change, I don't think. The administration denied that it's interested in regime change. It wants Maduro gone. Now, Secretary Rubio may, you know, have some thought that if Maduro goes, the regime will collapse and there'll be a democratic transition. I'm not, you know, persuaded of that. I think you could very easily have, Chavismo without either Chavez or Maduro. You know, get some other. All these generals are incredibly complicit in the narcotics trafficking. They're all dirty. So, you know, if we get somebody else, but Maduro's gone, have we advanced U.S. national interests? I don't think so. I don't think it's really about narcotics, although that's obviously kind of the excuse they're using. Because if it was about narcotics, he would not have, you know, just pardoned the president of Honduras, who was found guilty in the United States of narcotics trafficking, was about to start his sentence. I think, you know, Ted Johnson, our former colleague here at the Bulwark, had a piece in the Washington Post, and I think he may come closest to the truth about what's motivating Trump, which is Trump has a sense that what marks a great president is success at both ending and winning wars. And, you know, he's claimed that he's ended 8 wars. We were just talking about that. But he has to win one. You know, and what better way to have a splendid little war, to coin a phrase, than to, you know, launch one against, you know, a bunch of ragtag drug runners, in Venezuela. And, it's perfect because neither you or I are going to defend Maduro. You know, we would like, as you said, to see Maduro gone. We'd like to see, you know, Maria Corina Machado, either preside over or succeed as president of Venezuela as the leader of the democratic opposition through some kind of, you know, legitimate, you know, process. Can you imagine any of the current generals, you know, leading the coup that leads to a process of democratization? I can't.
No, I can't. Apparently his terms, Maduro's terms, were he wanted to take away $200 million and 100 of the top generals, and not go to Russia, which is chillier than Venezuela, but to Cuba. And so there's that. Look, this may still work. I mean, Maduro may break and leave, but I think there's an equally good chance that we end up bombing a country with which we are, in theory, not at war. And the attacks on the boats, that it really troubles me, because I worry about how that gets extended. I mean, if you can define any of those groups as terrorists, well, then you can do the same. You should be able to do the same thing in the United States.
Well, particularly since the Secretary of Defense has said he wants to make the army more, you know, the military more lethal against our enemies at home and abroad.
Right. And so it takes you to down a terrible path. Okay. Well, that's Venezuela. We should talk about Russia, Ukraine.
Yeah. But before we do that, we still, you know, we're not, you know, we haven't left Secretary Hegseth in the dunking tub yet, because he also today got the bad news of publication of the IG report on Signalgate. We don't have to, you know, I think go on at great length about this, but the report exonerated him having broken the law, because technically he's the classification authority and therefore he can, you know, declassify anything he chooses to declassify. The report did find him, however, in violation of a number of Department of Defense protocols, because he put operational detailed information that had been classified on an unclassified device to share with others without regard to whether or not it might, you know, might be accessed by adversaries, which could have put U.S. forces in some at some risk and in some peril. So total exoneration, according to the Republicans, the predictable ones like Senator Eric Schmidt of Missouri, total exoneration. You know, he didn't break the law, but he did things that, you know, showed, in my view, and, you know, I think that of the Inspector General, incredibly poor judgment.
Well, I'll just share what a good friend of mine who has high-level government experience said when I was fussing and fuming about this. She said, oh, come on, cut him some slack. It was baby's first airstrike.
Yeah, right.
He's so proud.
I just, you know, for one second, I will defend the Obama administration briefly on Libya, which is to say they did not have an authorization from the Congress of the United States. That's correct. They did have a United Nations Security Council resolution, however. So, I mean, they had some basis for their use of force. There's nothing here. So
I'm just. I'm sorry. That's globalist claptrap, if you ask me.
Well, there you go. Wait a second.
There's a serious point, though, which I intend to make in an Atlantic piece if we end up going to war. If you escape an authorization for the use of military force, if you basically define away war as war, then you don't, you excuse yourself from having to think really seriously about ends and means and what's the pathway. It becomes something else. That's exactly, I think the Obama administration deserves a lot of blame because they thought, okay, we'll fire off 100 Tomahawks, a bunch of other airstrikes, and that's it. We have no responsibility. And as we now know, as awful as Gaddafi was, this is, you know, unleashed a whole bunch of demons came out as that regime fell apart. And so,
I agree, of course, as you know, and it was particularly unseemly for a group of people who had spent a lot of time beating up folks like us in the Bush administration for not having thought through all the consequences of going to war in Iraq.
Right.
And so, you know, look, fair point. Why criticize us for that? But what's goose, you know, sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
And by the way, then had the chutzpah to come around to a number of us and ask us to make the case on Capitol Hill.
Yes. Yes.
Which I declined to do.
Yeah. Well, we can talk further about that. I do want to ask you one thing. Like last time we spoke, you expressed some misgivings about the video that Senator Slotkin, Senator Kelly, some other Democrats put out about whether people should follow illegal orders. Just out of curiosity, because you and I have exchanged notes on Nick Cattagio's column in the Dispatch, where he put that video in now in the context of what we know about the reporting of these strikes. Does that change your view at all?
It changes it somewhat, but my chief objection to that video was I thought 98% of that video was fine. The part that was not fine is they referenced the Trump administration. And I forget what the exact line, but there was one or two sentences about this administration doing dangerous things or potentially illegal things. And that, I think, was a mistake. That is to say, it seems to me it's entirely appropriate for senators and representatives to say, look, here are the standards for soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, space guardians, what have you. At all times, under all circumstances, you do not obey illegal orders, and we keep an eye on these things and we monitor them. But by inserting a critique of the Trump administration, they open themselves to being interpreted as being political and, in a certain sense, inciting people to disobey. There is an issue here, which is, do you really want to have every soldier all the time deciding for themselves whether an order is legal or not? Or do you want them, by and large, to say, on the whole, if we've gotten that order from the chain of command, I assume the chain of command is doing the proper thing and is properly advised. Now, there are circumstances where there are no circumstances where you say it's okay to machine gun a bunch of kids in a playground. Then the soldier's got to make that common sense decision for themselves.
Yeah, that's the Cali. That's the, you know, that's the William Cali.
But there are dicier circumstances. So, for example, I believe in Somalia was the case that when our troops were under attack in Mogadishu, the other side would put children, women and children, in front of them as human shields. And it's a terrible thing, but my understanding of the law of war is that under those circumstances, you can fire. And
you can.
You can.
Yeah.
You're permitted to. And, you know, in a circumstance like that, you do want soldiers to obey orders. So there's a bit of a hazard here. But for me, that's the critical part of that video, is there should not have been any reference to any particular administration or political figure whatsoever.
I hear what you're saying, but I guess in the current circumstance, I kind of see that as a venial, not a mortal sin.
I get it. I think that's right. I mean, it did seem very peculiar to me that where did this thing come from?
I think the timing suggests that they had been apprised of some of all of this.
So. Yeah, probably.
Let's move on to the seemingly certain denouement of the Witkoff-Kushner mission to Moscow, which only slightly exceeds in silliness the Joseph Davies mission to Moscow back in the 1930s. There's a similar kind of level of credulousness, particularly by Witkoff, but I guess Kushner as well, about all these blandishments of, you know, big business deals to be done with Russia, if they can only get, those crabbed Ukrainians to, give up their country.
Well, I've tried to think a lot about this because I doubt that Steve Witkoff and certainly Jared Kushner, if you gave them IQ tests, would fall out as idiots. But I think these are people who are so deeply immersed in a certain kind of commercial environment that they who are so incurious, or so unreflective that they can't imagine that maybe there's a different logic here than in real estate negotiations. But I think you see this, you see this with successful people in lots of walks of life. Think about all the tech bros who react to any kind of effort to restrain AI or any other technology as, you people are just fools, you don't understand what this is all about. Professors are the same way. You know, there are plenty of professors out there, as we both know, and intellectuals who cannot imagine any other way of thinking about the world than the one that, I don't know, they've imbibed through international relations theory, and who are not reflective enough to say, hang on, maybe there's a different way of understanding it. That I think is their real problem. The good news here, however, well, it's not good news, it's terrible news. I think what we've seen repeatedly, and Trump does not want to believe this, is Putin will only accept a deal on absolutely maximal terms, because Putin, who, by the way, is also very much in a bubble, I do believe.
Oh, God, yes.
Thinks that he is winning this war, and it's just whether he's going to win it with another couple hundred thousand dead, which doesn't trouble him from a moral point of view.
Or
without it. So he's going to crater it. What this is not, I believe, is, as some of our friends think, is that Trump is just out to screw the Ukrainians and destroy them, and to buddy up to Putin. And that, while I don't deny that he's got a certain kind of fascination with Putin, the fact is we're sharing intelligence. Europeans are buying weapons, and the oil sanctions, particularly against Lukoil and Rosneft, actually do have a real impact on, say, a country like India buying oil, and those have not been lifted. So you know, I think we have to factor that in. One other thing, which is just a question that I want to ask you, because part of Putin's negotiating tactic when he deals with these guys is he keeps them waiting for 3 hours to meet him. And I, for the life of me, and I know he's done this with other people, including when we were in government, this is his part of his establishing dominance technique. For the life of me, I don't understand why representatives of the greatest country on earth, to wit, the United States of America, don't say after 20 minutes, well, we must have been mistaken. This was not the day that President Putin meant to meet us. We're telling the plane to start the engines and we're just leaving. And next, when he wants to talk, let us know. If you can explain that one to me.
Now, I can't, because I totally agree with you. I mean, look, when I accompanied Secretaries Gates and Rice to Moscow in, I think it was September of 2008, when we were meeting with the Russians, they were talking about missile defense and whatnot. Putin kept them at his dacha waiting, you know, for an hour and a half. We were all sitting, cooling our heels, you know, at the Osobnyak, which is the sort of Ministry of Foreign Affairs guest house where most, you know, U.S. Soviet and U.S. Russian negotiations on arms control and other topics have been held. And we were sitting there waiting for, you know, a couple of hours while this all went on. And I'm with you. I mean, my attitude is, okay, you don't want to meet? We're leaving. Goodbye. You know, we don't need this meeting. You need this meeting. But part of this is because Putin is trying to convince them not only that he's the, you know, alpha, but also that Russia's winning this war and doesn't need the U.S. The U.S. needs him. When I think the reverse is actually the case. I mean, you know, he knows that Witkoff and Kushner and Trump are all very susceptible to the argument, you know, Russia's big and it's going to win. You know, Ukraine is weak and, you know, it's can't possibly take on Russia forever. Truth is, you know, and this is something that, you know, our friends at the Institute for the Study of War pointed out, you know, if the Russians were to continue to make their advances at the current rate of advance, it would take them years to conquer the entire Donbas. Meanwhile, their economy is, you know, turning into a giant basket case. Defense industry can't get the inputs it needs. Inflation is running high. They've got labor shortages. It's literally, you know, he's got the economy bursting at the seams. It's about to collapse and fall apart. So he's the one who really needs the help. Although I agree with you, he thinks he's winning because that's what he's being told by his military and his intelligence people. Just as he was told that the Ukrainians would give up after, you know, 72 hours when he launched the war to begin with.
How do you assess the impact of this scandal in Ukraine, which has taken down Andriy Yermak, who was Zelensky's chief of staff? I will tell you, most of the Ukrainians I know and people who I know who care a lot about Ukraine are not unhappy to see Yermak go. On the other hand, there's this feeling that what Zelensky's wartime leadership has not been Churchillian in the sense that he's really keeping an eye on the actual conduct of military affairs. He's Mr. Outside. Yermak has been Mr. Inside, but also has been preoccupied with consolidating power. There was even talk for a while that he was thinking of running for president. And I have to say, and I'm a great admirer of Zelensky, that his time, he will, look, he saved the country in many respects. It will be a good thing for him to step down, as he has said he will after the war's over, and hand over to somebody like General Zaluzhny, who's now the Ukrainian ambassador to Great Britain.
And who also has political ambitions.
And who has political ambitions. But I have to say, he's been very adroit. His public statements are very weak vanilla.
I would make a couple of observations here. One, first of all, this has been, the timing of this has not been ideal from certain points of view. On the other hand, it's probably a good thing that it's happened, you know, overall. It shows that the anti-corruption institutions in Ukraine are working. I mean, corruption is a problem in Ukraine. It has been, just as in all the former Soviet space.
It's as in the United States, by the way, I would say. I mean,
Putin's doing an excellent job of importing the corruption into the United States. I mean, if you read the Wall Street Journal article on all the Trump cronies who are lining up behind the, you know, Witkoff Kushner, you know, gravy train, it's, you know, astounding. But so that's on the one hand. On the other hand, it's obviously, you know, whetted Putin's appetite. He thinks the Ukrainians are weak, so he can drive a hard bargain right now. And I think it's also had that effect on people like Witkoff and Trump, who think, oh, perfect time for us to now pressure the Ukrainians to make concessions so we could get a deal, any kind of deal. We don't care what kind of deal, because we want the deal so that we can go in and, you know, get Russian rare earth minerals and make money. And as if American companies are lining up to go do business deals in a country that has zero rule of law, where if you cross the wrong people, you get tossed out of a 40-story window. I mean, it's kind of ludicrous, frankly, but you know, there it is. I mean, there is one very serious, I mean, the Ukrainians have a very serious demographic problem. That's been, you know, it existed before the war. The war has exacerbated it. The Ukrainians also, you know, to my earlier comments about the Russians on the battlefield, the Russians have developed some very, they've adapted too. They've been slower to adapt than the Ukrainians, but they have adapted how they're fighting, and they figured out a way how to use their drones to interdict Ukrainian logistics, which has been a big problem for the Ukrainians in the defense of Pokrovsk, and will be a big problem unless they figure out ways, which I'm confident they will, but unless they figure out some ways to blunt this tactic of the Russians, it's going to make the defense of the so-called fortress belts, you know, in the Donbass, you know, much in, you know, Kramatorsk, Konstantinivka, these other places, going to make it very tough. So they're going to have to, you know, do that. But, you know, we don't get a normal assessment, you know, from this administration. We just get people responding to, you know, what somebody told them, as opposed to, you know, deep understanding or analysis of the intelligence, et cetera.
Well, again, as we've, I think we've both said at various points, the fact that it's an administration that really doesn't do process, that I don't think really respects any kind of bureaucratic expertise, you're going to have a whole bunch of these either misjudgments or lack of any judgment whatsoever. They're just going to pile up and accumulate. And I think, unfortunately, the price that will be paid is going to be sometime down the road. But it's going to be very substantial. And we'll have to see when that happens. Although, as you know, I think the good news is that it's an administration that in some respects gets steadily weaker over the remaining 3 years here for political reasons, and partly because Trump is just aging. You know, you mentioned that he keeps on falling asleep. I think you're going to see more and more of that, and I think that's probably somewhat less dangerous than having him be hyperactive, but I'm not entirely certain of that judgment.
I think, you know, this is an administration that's peopled, you know, populated, I should say, by a lot of sketchy characters with a poor understanding and lack of judgment. And there's nothing worse than that. I'm afraid we've kind of exhausted our time here, if not our audience. So we're going to have to bring this episode of S.H.I.E.L.D. to a close. But look forward to seeing you next week. And hopefully,
I'm sure there'll be a lot of good news.
Boom into the you know, body politic.
I was going to say, enough of it. I'm sure there'll be lots of good news by next week. So we'll just hang on for that one.
Okay.
COTA just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with COTA. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.